This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome to this week's 45th podcast. I'm here with Watch, who is filling in for Robbie this week. So I just saw that you updated our outline right before we started with the late breaking news of Sarah Sanders is leaving the White House, which, how could you even tell? Like, what's the difference going to be?
Yeah, let's just have the world's smallest violin play for Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
But, like, no one's even going to notice. Like, I really thought, like, wasn't she announcing she's going to be gone back in, like, December?
So. Well, yeah, because the White House has not held press briefings, which used to be a staple. But now she's going back to Arkansas, and Donald Trump has tweeted out support and thanks for her and has recommended that she run for the governor of Arkansas. So let's see what she does. But for those who are listening and those who think, oh, she's going to be shunned, I'm in D.C., and let me just tell you, there's a revolving door, and the way it works is that she's going to fail up. She's going to probably write a book. She's going to go on a book tour. She's going to be a paid contributor on a cable news channel. She's going to be an advisor, a well-paid advisor.
You say that, but I'm not so optimistic. She's not going to be shunned. She's not going to be, like, thrown out of polite society. But I don't think the assumption that she's going to have no consequences is, well, one, likely in her case in particular, and two, borne out by, like, say, Spicer, because where the hell is he now?
Tell you exactly where he was. A night before the White House correspondence dinner in D.C., there was a bougie party thrown by my agency. So I just went for like 10 minutes because I had to show my face. And it was a lot of these folks, reporters and journalists, a lot of the execs. And guess who was there mingling and having a great time?
Spicer.
Sean Spicer.
He's not going to be shunned. What I'm saying is that he's not going to have the kind of professional opportunities that a former White House press advisor should have.
See, this is where I disagree, because the right-wing media infrastructure is tribal, and they have enough clout that they will help her. She's going to write a book. She's going to go on a book tour. She'll get her own show. She'll be a contributor. She'll be an advisor. Things will be very good for Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
And okay, just, bougie parties aside, though, why is Spicer not getting that? If
he wrote a book. He was on a book tour. Didn't they interview him on The View? Like, you know, he was invited to do a segment on the Emmys when Stephen Colbert, of all people, was hosting. He was made a fellow at the Harvard School of Government, both him and Lewandowski, by the way. And so why not Sanders? I mean, don't you think, like, look, if it was you or me and we had any shame, and we'd behave the way Sarah Huckabee Sanders did, we'd probably, like, go into a corner and like, cry for, like, a week and then, like, you know, like, beat ourselves up and do penance.
Well, that's obviously not who she is. I just, well, don't see the governor. One, that's not, well, it's Arkansas, so who knows. But I don't see her. I know the Mueller report and her lying is not going to be, like, shocking news. But also, I do think that's damaging to her and her brand. Like, she's officially caught lying, had to admit it. She's been kind of quiet on the various shows mostly. Well, not that I pay attention to that. I think she's going to Arkansas to sort of back off her career for a little while. We'll see.
I just like it. This might be the rare times where I'm more cynical than you.
I'm cynical. I just think that she's damaged goods still.
Can we share her classic tweet, which I brought up?
There's so many.
When you're attacking FBI agents because you're under criminal investigation, you're losing. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, one of my all-time favorite Sarah Huckabee Sanders tweets, November 3rd, 2016.
And I don't think necessarily that the Mueller report and her leaving was unrelated, too. They obviously, she was announcing hints she's going to depart before that came out, but she knew at the time that she had told Mueller she'd lied about various things. And I think it's possible that's more behind this than they're officially letting on.
So you think basically she's saving her own skin?
No, I think it's become, it's untenable. Like, she's begun, she cannot do the job. The job doesn't exist anymore. There's no point in having her there. She's no longer a credible source. I think for a lot of reasons, she needed to get out of there.
Will Kellyanne Conway replace her?
She won't be replaced. I mean, that's my guess. She might, maybe they will have a fake, you know, fake replacement for Sanders. But there's, I mean, her job doesn't exist anymore, so why would they replace it?
I mean, once in a while, they still do the press briefings. And when was the last one?
Like 50 days ago. I mean, they had the one for the, like, the kids one. That was the last one. Before that, it was like a couple months.
So it's like one of those ceremonial positions, right? Just someone just come out like once every like 50 days to just give the artifice.
Trump's going to want to do that. Trump will want to do it himself and do his disastrous, creepy press conferences. So she's probably just like, oh, this job's no longer a job. Time to go home.
But yeah, after Spicer has fallen, Sanders has fallen, and let's see who takes up the mantle for the next 2 years of this presidency, which is doing just fine.
It's going to be Conway or no one. Conway's won that job from the start.
Conway, speaking of Conway, would you like to address other breaking news today?
Yeah, well, Kellyanne Conway, as usual, is in trouble with the Under the Hatch Act, and this time it's gotten semi-serious, I would say.
I think that's fair.
I mean, it's serious as, like, she's not going to prison like she likes to joke about, so in this administration, it's kind of meaningless, which I hate to say because that's the whole problem here, but they're right. This is a meaningless gesture from, you know, a kind of last gasp of, like, the normative government tradition.
But is it meaningless, though? I mean, at least they're trying.
Oh, it's not meaningless, but it's not going to go. It's not going to go anywhere. It's almost worse because they knew. I mean, they had to suspect a bit. So the Hatch Act is an act that says government employees, while they're on the government clock, are under, you know, government power. When they've got the uniform on, when they're, you know, doing government deeds, they cannot campaign. They cannot try and influence the outcome of the election. And it does not apply to the president. It does not apply to the vice president. It's all political because their job's political, but they can't try and influence the election. Is the kind of the line that gets drawn, and Kellyanne Conway has been very unconcerned by the entire deal. Early on, like 2017, and a couple times she got in trouble for violating the rules against them promoting like private concerns. She'd like promote Ivanka's goods or like books or whatever. And
her clothing line.
She does seem, I don't think she's actually done that in a while. So maybe she really did back off from that one. When it comes to Hatch Act violations, she's just picking up steam. So last year, like March 2018, early 2018, there was a recommendation from the Office of Special Counsel. Now, it's not Mueller. It's very different. It's an independent agency that stands on its own. It's permanent. And Office of Special Counsel sent a letter to the White House saying, Kellyanne Conway is violating the Hatch Act. We recommend disciplinary action. And the White House promptly threw it in the trash. Right. So apparently in the past few months, it's kind of heated up again, and Office of Special Counsel has been sending letters, you know, having meetings with White House saying, well, Kellyanne Conway is still violating the Hatch Act. Something should happen here. And then Kellyanne Conway just apparently stopped giving two shits. And a little while ago, there was a quote from her where she said, someone asked her about the Hatch Act thing, and she's like, let me know when the prison sentence starts.
Right. Or she goes, jail, 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 prison sentence. She just laughs it off.
Yeah,
because she knows it's a corrupt administration. They have her back. They're not going to do anything. And the White House press secretary already responded.
That's the problem, is that did put OSC in a hard position. She is openly scoffing at their power, at their enforcement obligation, at their duty. Like they exist, their mandate, what they're required to do as employees of that office is to pursue and investigate Hatch Act violations. So to have a senior high level White House advisor blow it off, that brought the issue to a head. They had no choice but to either decide, either A, we're going to stop them doing what the agency's supposed to do and get in trouble possibly for that. I mean, not in the current administration, but later down the line. Or B, they're going to, you know, actually do something, knowing they have no power to enforce anything, and have their power just tossed aside when they try. They went for option B, and what we saw was the letter from Office of Special Counsel that not only recommended, I mean, point out her Hatch Act violations, but actually recommended her firing and said the White House should dismiss her for these violations.
And they're not. And they're absolutely not.
Now, the violations she's charged with have to do with sort of two big categories. The first is her Twitter account. She's always used the same Twitter account since like 2012, I think. And when she got into the White House, she didn't get a new Twitter account. She didn't start like a, you know, White House aide Kellyanne Conway account. She kept using her same one, which she used to retweet like stuff in the administration, her personal stuff, just random tweets from her. So it's a big grab bag of stuff. And Office Special Counsel is declaring this a government Twitter account because she uses it frequently for government-based activities like promoting the administration and what they're doing. And so her role of like messaging,
also promoting certain candidates and elections.
Yes. And well, so she's so personal, like she is allowed to do that personally. Like that's not, people who work for the government aren't prevented from political activities, just only when they're doing it on the clock, so to speak. So the problem is that her,
and she's always on the clock.
Well, she can't, I mean, that would be a First Amendment violation if she was always on the clock and she couldn't ever speak out politically.
But the nebulous realm which she lives in, like, allows this type of leeway, especially when it's done with such bad faith. And that's why I keep going back to, it's all bad faith actors who don't even care. about the ethical norms and guidelines,
it's
right?
It's not so nebulous. It's not supposed to be nebulous. That's why the rules exist, is to keep like a firm delineation. You remember when, what's her, oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking on her name. Our former UN,
Nikki Haley.
Haley, there we go. She also got in trouble for this because she had a Twitter account that she started using for both business and personal use. And she was really upset when she had to start a new one and lose all her, like, whatever, millions of followers. And she was really stroppy about that.
Everyone cares about a cloud. So,
but she did, she did go along with it in the end. Whereas Kellyanne Conway is just like, nope, not going to bother with that. And the other issue, which I think is the more clear cut, I mean, it is the clear cut violation. The Twitter stuff is problematic, but I think that it's a little bit less firm footing. But where it's really clear she's violated the Hatch Act is her interviews. She has regularly gone on various cable shows. I don't know whatever shows she's going on as top senior White House aide. And she is making campaign statements. She is talking about Doug Jones. She's talking, that was one that got in trouble last year in particular. Yeah. She is advocating against certain candidates. And that is a big old line in the sand, no-no. Now, so the response from the White House was to have, what's his name, Cipollone, the White House lawyer, write a letter, like an 11-page letter back to Office Special Counsel saying, like, we demand that you retract your, like, statement right now. How dare you do this? Like not give Kellyanne Conway her due process rights and all that stuff. It's a pretty remarkable letter how aggressive they were in their approach. And in fact, they demanded that the Office Special Counsel produce all of its internal communications about this matter. So basically, they're going to war with Office Special Counsel.
But it's also for the narrative, right? It establishes a narrative that is comfortable with the right-wing media infrastructure and for his base. And it also...
Oh, no one's going to read that.
But it's also alleging with the OSC is that, like, they're uneven and biased and don't fairly apply this. And what about the Democrats? It's a strategy that is used repeatedly. And I'm sure with the rest of this conversation, with the other breaking news, though, we see that nonetheless works for the base, right? You both sides it. You become the victim and you say things aren't evenly applied. Then you say, what about? It's all about what about is all done in bad faith, which then corrodes trust in these institutions and these independent organizations that otherwise actually have a very good reputation are trying to do their job. And so now, like,
they're going to try for me, that.
Yeah, but it works, right? Because what happens then, because look, we know nothing's going to happen to Kellyanne Conway, but the detrimental effect of this act is that it erodes what? Any power, if there was any power of the OSC, it erodes any public trust in it, and it further causes divisions, and at the end of the day, it allows Kellyanne Conway to essentially go on violating the Hatch Act.
So the problem is, though, like Henry Koerner, they're obviously trying to position themselves a little bit to be like, oh, the OSC is not applying this law equally between Democrats and Republicans. But also, Henry Koerner is absolutely right-wing. Trump appointed him. He's got, you know, his right-wing bona fides. Like, he is not going to be a person that can be targeted with this whole "you're actually a Democrat" kind of attack they're going for.
See, I don't think it matters anymore, because I'll just point to Justin Amash. I'm a Tea Party conservative who literally was the founder of the Freedom Caucus, has now, you know, gone on the offensive against Trump after reading the Mueller report and after explaining to his constituents and even to the American public on Twitter why it's so damaging. What happened? His own caucus is now attacking him, right? So basically the precedent that is set, and you see this pattern, is the party belongs to Trump. Well, Trumpism is...
Yeah, but I feel like that's going to happen here.
But it doesn't matter. Like, my saying
is... No, this is different, though, because the problem here is that, like, actually, in this case, their only power is normative, and the administration doesn't care about norms. It's never going to get to the point where they're going to need to, like, attack him like Amish or whatever. Like, they don't have to do that here. They're just going to quietly discard the whole norm of following non-criminal, non-mandatory laws like the Hatch Act.
Right. No, that's what I'm saying. And that's the detrimental consequence, is the weakening of laws, of norms, of institutions, which actually is bad for our democracy. And because, look, power corrupts, right? So suppose a Democrat comes in and wins in 2020. Hey, if Trump has already weakened the enforceability of, say, the Hatch Act, why should I, you know, go out of my way to then be the good faith actor? What I'm saying?
He has. It's done deal. I think that ship's already sailed. I mean, you can argue about the merits of having things like the Hatch Act that are only enforceable through shame, as far as like government administration goes, or as far as like, you know, norm setting or institutional power. You could make an argument that it's not a good idea to have that kind of enforcement mechanism at all, because it can't enforce shit. But in the current administration and going forward, it is pretty clear that that's not going to be an effective mechanism, and that things that we rely on, basically shame, to guide behavior in government? No. They either give them teeth or get rid of it. So the Hatch Act's probably going to be either, I mean, I don't see right now them actually amending it to give it teeth, which means it'll probably just be discarded quietly, which means it's going to be really awkward at the OSC's office.
It's awkward everywhere. Like, my friends at the State Department are like, it's depressing. My friends at the DOJ are like, this is depressing. It's just because what reward is there for good behavior? None.
And they still also have a job to do, at least. They still have a job. Well, they still have a mission.
But at the same time, right, like, you hit the nail on the head, which is what people who've been warning about this say, you know, how democracies die is that institutions are only as good as the people who are behind them or running them. And a lot of our democracies, without us realizing, is literally based upon the good faith of actors doing, like, the good thing, like the Boy Scout, Girl Scout honor. What happens when an entire political party, we have a two-party system, you know, let's just be honest, Democrats, Republicans in America, when one party just abandons all good faith? What's the power then of the institution? The institution is corrupted and rots. And if these are the guidelines that are put in place for, you know, a democracy, for checks and balances, to hold the powerful accountable, it's dangerous times. That's all I'm saying. I'm not trying to be...
I'm not screwing with that. I just think this is an interesting edge case because obviously all institutions are under threat and it's a problem across the board. But in this scenario, we can see what happens when there is no enforcement power available. And then it does just kind of withers away, or most likely just kind of wither away. And I guess some poor, sad person's going to show up at their office every day with no work to do because the Hatch Act's no longer getting enforced, or at least not for it gets the White House.
It's like that guy from Office Space who no one knows what he does, but just sits in the corner.
That's going to be OSC, at least for the Hatch Act against the White House.
Slowly goes postal.
If you've been listening to this show or to Undisclosed, you've heard us talk about Framebridge before. And that's because Framebridge makes it super easy and affordable to frame your favorite things, from art prints and posters to travel photos on your phone.
So here's how it works. Just go to framebridge.com and upload your photo. That means I'm going to be uploading photos of my kids. Or they'll send you packaging to safely mail in your physical piece of photo. If you're one of those people who still has physical pieces of photo, I salute you. You preview your items online in any frame style. You choose your favorite, or you get free recommendations from their talented designers. The expert team at Framebridge will customize frame your item and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. Instead of hundreds you'd pay at a framing store, their prices start at an affordable $39, and all shipping is free. Plus, listeners of the 45th podcast will get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use the code 45th, 45TH.
Yeah, so true story, I recently did not use Framebridge because I'm a dummy and tried to order a frame online for something I had that I thought would be pretty simple. The frame I got, I guess the staining on it was bad, and it left this like black tarry shit on everything it touched. It was the worst. It's on the wall, my hands, my table. It was really dumb, and yeah, I'm not bothering that again because Framebridge is so easy and the prices are so great. Seriously, you look at framing costs at like a lot of stores you go to in town, it's really pricey. You're just like, okay, I'll just like tack it to a wall. I don't need frames, really. You do, and Framebridge can help you get them. So to get started today, to frame your photos or to send the perfect gift for weddings, birthdays, special events, go to framebridge.com and use the promo code 45th, and you'll save an additional 15% off your first order. Just go to framebridge.com, promo code 45th. Framebridge.com, promo code 45th.
Can we talk about Elaine Chao? Because I just feel like that story got buried.
We can.
Speaking about corruption, how it just like, you know, just becomes the norm and we just move on.
I mean, even corruption aside, this is why we should not have the leader of the Senate being married to someone in the president's cabinet.
Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, was also the wife of Mitch McConnell.
Yes, because one, the appearances are bad. And two, it gets ugly fast when things start looking kind of corrupt.
So very quickly, and I just want to ask you, after I set this up, what do you think is going to happen? So Chao allegedly has used her, quote, connections and status as the Secretary of Transportation to boost her family's major maritime company, which has deep ties in China. And also, she has asked that her family members be included in a meeting in China. I think she probably takes that cue from Donald Trump. Also, to make it worse, she has designated one of her staffers to steer federal funds to Kentucky. Now, for those of you who are paying attention, Her husband is Mitch McConnell, who also happens to be the senator from Kentucky. And so the aide reportedly helped shepherd grant applications of interest to McConnell in the lead up to his reelection. And those applications totaled to $78 million. This was thanks to reporting from Politico. I just love, first and foremost, how it's so naked and transparent. Like, they don't even hide it anymore, which is kind of awesome. I appreciate that, number one. Number two, this story just came out earlier this week. It is a big story. What will happen to Elaine Chao, if anything, Susan Simpson?
Well, I don't want to totally dismiss or downplay the political story on McConnell and the alleged fast-tracking of Kentucky projects. But I am far less concerned by that than I am by the her involvement with her family's company and their contracts in China. To me, that is, I mean, it's independent from McConnell, separate from that, and is much, much bigger threat to infrastructure, to, you know, just operation of American democracy. The other one is kind of sleazy in a way that's a little more familiar and not exactly novel in the current. I mean, that shit happens in D.C. It's not great, but it also doesn't seem like it'd be an extreme outlier or an extreme piece of power from what I've seen so far. Now, maybe that's definitely worth investigating more and to learn more. But that one, I think, if the House is going to investigate anything, make it the story about her family's company, because there is such an inherent conflict of interest there. And the New York Times story was exhaustive and amazing. And yeah, like you said, it got very little traction.
Yeah, very little traction, because we have a lot more chaos to get to. But also, a follow-up story from today is that there's caution and fear from some House Democrats to actually go and do some full-blown investigation of Elaine Chao because of her position as Secretary of Treasury. They fear there will be retaliation, and specifically retaliation when it comes to much-needed funds for their state's infrastructure. It's all bad.
Well, also McConnell, you know, I mean, it's his wife. So if you're in the Senate, and I mean, not that any Republican's going to be taking any action now, but, you know, in a hypothetical world where they would, that'd be a good reason not to take action against Secretary of Treasury, because her husband is your boss and can make your life miserable.
And will make your life miserable. Senate Majority Leader will use all of his powers as a baseball bat against you. So I predict nothing will happen to Elaine Chao, and her family will become very rich, even though there is a huge
conflict.
They're
already conflict. Very rich.
We'll get richer, richer.
Less, I mean, that's rich. Like who funds McConnell's like campaigns. So
yeah, like major FU money.
Yeah.
Like all middle fingers on all appendages type of FU money.
Oh, God. I had a nightmare. We'll get back to it in a bit. But like, so Chao's family, they're like in shipping. They do, you know, just maritime transport and whatnot. Major Chinese company. I hope they don't have any like tankers or anything.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting.
Just a thought. Anyway, I think that, I mean, her status more than other secretaries does make her harder for people in Congress and Senate to look at. Because, yeah, having her approve major $1 billion infrastructure items for your state's a big deal. It's kind of what a lot of senators and congressmen are there for. So she may have a little bit of immunity there. I would hope that it would not be enough where it's going to be a total investigation.
Yeah, it'll probably just linger on, and then it'll just linger on and it'll be dismissed. But I am glad that
Zinke went away. The guy, I always, Pruitt went away.
Pruitt went away, and he has a huge laundry list of violations. Zinke did go away, you're correct.
It took forever. It took way too long, and it was awful, but it did eventually, actually, it did work.
And it seems Ben Carson is going to go away pretty soon.
I forgot he was still there.
Yeah, yeah, leave his position at HUD. He'll do damage before he goes, of course. And yeah, maybe Lewandowski's out, gone. Spicer's gone. Like we said, Huckabee Sanders is gone. But someone probably far worse will come in. And the stink will rise. But that's where we're at right now. And speaking of stink, I always love talking about Michael Flynn. Some good Michael Flynn news this week, Susan.
I don't know if it's good. Well, we'll see. So Flynn is one of the people from the Mueller investigation who was charged. His case pled guilty, and their cases have not been wrapped up. There's still a few lingering around. Actually, I think probably about a good number of them. I mean, Stone obviously hasn't got a trial yet. Gates is still cooperating. I'm not actually entirely certain what's going on with that. You've got the Assange stuff going on.
We're waiting for the sentencing, which got postponed.
Yeah, but like, why are they still putting it up? Like, what more are they doing? And there's some like little side cases, like some of Flynn's little lackeys, like Bijan Keon, whatever their names are, who are involved in sort of low-level grift, corruption, FARA violations, that kind of deal. So Flynn has not been sentenced for a few reasons. One, that he needs cooperation in upcoming trials. And two, they seem to have the like strategy of delaying his sentencing because the judge in his case was kind of pissy, and I think that they were afraid that
very pissy. Like,
yeah. So I hope he's not listening. Sorry, Judge, if you are. I don't mean it. but that's one of the reasons he has not actually had his case finalized. Now, recently this week, and there's been a lot of talk, and it's been kind of a thing where it's like chatter, where it's a lot of like the QAnon kind of people. So you don't really listen to it, but you know, the family is involved. Michael Flynn's family is involved, and they're always tweeting about it. So you kind of wonder. But there's been like kind of a steady drumbeat that Flynn's going to withdraw his guilty plea. And it didn't happen, hasn't happened. So maybe this is, again, just more baseless rumors. But this week, he fired his counsels at Covington & Burling. And that started new speculation. Like, why would he do this? Is it because he ran out of money? Well, apparently not. Nope. So why did he do it? And he has now hired a new attorney. He's kind of like a B-lister, right-wing, like Fox News attorney, Sidney Powell.
Who promotes all the Fox News conspiracy theories, by the way.
Yeah, but she's B-list. She's solid B-list. She's not like Tenzing or anyone like that. She's definitely lower down the the food chain, but still high profile. I'm not saying she's a real attorney and she's high, like, okay, fine. Where it gets really weird is where this morning Trump was tweeting out about it and said, quote, General Michael Flynn, the 33-year war hero who has served with distinction, has not retained a good lawyer. He has retained a great lawyer, all caps, Sidney Powell. Best wishes and good luck to them both. Now, this is essentially the stay strong text, part two.
Right.
We know that in 2017, Trump sent a message to Flynn saying, stay strong. Against what? Well, you know, the Mueller investigation, which didn't even exist then, I don't think, but investigations in general. And this is more of that. And it suggests kind of alarmingly that there could be a plan here. That's not at all a hypothetical or conspiracy theory, given that Dowd's voicemail to Flynn's attorney it was playing what they were offering. I mean, it was a threat. And then voicemail, if you haven't listened to it, you should go listen to it right now. Trump's attorney.
That's a piece of news that everyone forgot, right?
Yeah. It was from Mueller report had it in it too. So we've known about it for a while. But hearing it's pretty like, Jesus Christ, these guys. Mickey Mouse impeachment club over here. Dowd's voicemail basically laid out two choices in a voicemail. What the frick was he thinking? I mean, seriously, like you make that a phone call. You don't leave a recording of you doing it. And he just says that, like, hey, we need to know about Flynn. If Flynn is in. What he does eventually sort of lay out in a very indirect fashion and very confusingly worded is like, one, there's two options here. I mean, Flynn's obviously cooperating to some degree. If he's cooperating just to like get a low deal, that's fine. But if he's cooperating and turning in Trump, then we have a national security issue that we need to talk about. But if it's the former thing, if it's the thing where Flynn is basically just admitting to some small stuff so we can get a agreement and move on, well, the president wants him to know that he still has a lot of fond feelings for him and we're all in favor of him. Which seems to be the case because, you know, Flynn is still, to me, the biggest mystery of the Mueller investigation. I do not understand what happened with Flynn, why that deal was reached, why right. Mueller allowed it. Mueller was constrained by the fact that people he was trying to prosecute had a friend that could pardon them. So that definitely did affect the plea bargaining strategy. But for what he did, Flynn got an amazingly sweet deal.
It was this...
We don't know yet.
We don't know, right? But it was like a kind of a sweetheart deal for all of the alleged crimes.
It was a really good deal. Flynn had a lot of things he'd done that were pretty black and white. The FAR violations, yeah. The bribery. Like, there was a kickback he was involved in with his little friend over at, God, I forgot his name, right? Altekin, the Turkish dude. Like, it was a black and white, plainly documented.
To kidnap Gulen and literally, like, take him.
Oh, no, there's that thing, too. This was a more basic bribe that was, like, documented in black and white in his own financials that he posted in his FAR filings. They had him dead to rights on that. So, okay, fine. If you're making a deal, sometimes you charge some stuff and let the easy fish go away. But Flynn didn't give anything useful. What possibly motivated Mueller to decide that what Flynn had was good enough to warrant the deal when he only pleads guilty to the one count of lying to the FBI?
But I don't think we know right?
Well, we do know because we know that if Flynn had given anything actually valuable, we'd have seen it in the Mueller report. So clearly he didn't.
Why do you think that he got such a sweetheart deal?
I think Flynn's attorney played it really well, and he got his client an amazing deal. And I think Mueller may have made a bad call in what he did there. And I think now Flynn has worked out a strategy with the president where he can avoid his plea altogether and get a pardon. We'll see.
I think that's very clear. I mean, obviously we don't know, but like, look, he fires his attorney at the last second. He gets Sidney Powell, like you said, very pro-MAGA type of Fox News personality. You basically now are seeing these signals via tweets. You've heard from Michael Cohen, the right-hand man of Donald Trump, that this is how he speaks. And those who are part of Trump's orbit kind of just know, like a mob boss, how he talks. These are clues, codes. This is like the way Trump communicates, right? And so if you're looking at basically the pattern here, to me, it suggests I've got your back. You've been a good, loyal soldier. You haven't been a rat.
And the cover-up worked. Congratulations.
Cover-up worked. Just be a little bit more patient, and I'm going to pardon you, and I'm going to make you into a hero. And the right wing is going to accept him as a hero, right? Like, Flynn is already kind of still loved.
I don't know. He was a Democrat for a long time. He's kind of sketch.
Doesn't matter enough love to give him, like,
a stand. I don't think he's going to have status of, like, right-wing hero. He's just trying to get out of this without a criminal conviction.
See, this is where – it's so interesting. This is where I feel like I just know how that right-wing infrastructure works, and I feel like I'm not being cynical but very realistic. He will – be transformed into a martyr / hero. I don't think so.
It's not that I underestimate the willingness of the right wing to embrace like beloved right wing figures and make them heroes, but I just don't think that it applies universally. And I don't think supporting Trump on its own is itself enough to get you like permanent hero status. I think he's more likely to be like forgotten pretty quickly once he's out.
All right, look at the people at Trump's part. All have been resurrected their careers, right? Like Arpaio.
Okay. It's not resurrected. Like he's a sad old man who we don't hear that much from, thank God.
D'Souza.
We hear too much from him, but also he wasn't stopped already. He was still loud and on Fox all the time. So
I'm gonna stick with my prediction on Flynn. I hope I'm wrong. I believe he will be resurrected within the right wing.
But see, you use that word resurrected, and that means he ever had standing in the right wing. And he never really did. There's a reason, like, he's always been kind of, like, another B-lister, even before he lost his job, like, 17 days in. Like, a Scaramucci and a half into the administration.
Scaramucci, come on now. You can't compare Flynn to Scaramucci.
I say he's a Scaramucci and a half in his terms of timelines, not in terms of his personality.
And in terms of hair, I'll give it to you. Flynn still has good head of hair. It's not Scaramucci-level hair, but still. I'll give him on the hair level. They're on the same part. Okay, but I hope you're correct and I am wrong. I feel very confident in my prediction.
Like, I don't think it's going to have consequences. I don't think he's going to, like, suffer, like, being isolated and untalked to for the rest of his life. I just don't see him being he was not in the kind of place before where he could rise again. He never rose in the first place. Not in the way you're referring to. So I think he will get his pardon. It'll be a scandal and he'll probably just disappear into, like, the consulting world of making all the money.
But he did make that fateful appearance at the Republican National Convention where he led the lock her up chant, and which has become now, fast forward 2.5 years, part and parcel of the messaging arsenal.
Oh yeah, he'll probably do that again. I bet he'll appear at a campaign thing and do the same old routine. But he also has not been a Republican for very long, which I think does count to some degree.
Susan, there's a great new podcast coming out created by Nation Magazine called The Next Left. From the grassroots to the ballot box, we're witnessing an explosion of progressive political energy. There's new candidates that are running for public office, high and low, and they're winning. So each week, Next Left, this new podcast, its host, John Nichols, will interview rising politicians and activists at the city, state, and federal levels who are hoping to bring bold, progressive policies to their districts and to D.C. Next Left takes us into the lives of this new wave of politicians and explains how they plan to change our country for the better.
And they have an exciting episode this week featuring Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. She's the first Palestinian-American woman in Congress, and she'll be talking to John about Detroit's history in the civil rights movement, social security, and the current administration's corrupt pay-to-play politics. And don't miss the first two episodes, featuring incredible interviews with Ilhan Omar, Rosanna Rodriguez-Sanchez, and Lee Carter.
So check out Next Left. It's going to be the political podcast that gets personal right now. You can download and subscribe to Next Left wherever you get your wonderful podcasts. Okay, we have some big news, which we hopefully will not be forgotten by Friday, and the cynic in me thinks it will. A clip from the upcoming Donald Trump-George Stephanopoulos interview that will air on ABC News.
Let's hear from him, like hear from his own words. So Stephanopoulos, I don't actually know how he got this interview. Somehow he got 2 days kind of like open-ended with the president to talk about all kinds of random shit. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. So this is definitely not the only part of the interview worth checking out. But this one was a big one. And here is how Trump responded to questions about what he'd do in 2020 if someone came to him with information or dirt on an opponent.
Okay, let's put yourself in a position. You're a congressman. Somebody comes up and says, hey, I have information on your opponent. Do you call the FBI?
I'll tell you what,
I've seen a lot of things over my life. I don't think in my whole life I've ever called the FBI. In my whole life. You don't call the FBI. You throw somebody out of your office. You do whatever
you do. Al Gore got a stolen briefing book. He called the FBI.
Well, that's different. A stolen briefing book. This isn't a stolen. This is somebody that said, we have information on your opponent. Oh, let me call the FBI. Give me a break. Life doesn't work that way.
The FBI director says that's what should happen.
The FBI director is wrong.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong. But when somebody comes up with OPPO research, right? They come up with OPPO research. Oh, let's call the FBI. The FBI doesn't have enough agents to take care of it. But you go and talk honestly to congressmen. They all do it. They always have. And that's the way it is. It's called OPPO research.
So, yeah, it's more Trumpian word salad. And the Republicans are going to treat it like Trumpian word salad. I already saw a few quotes from a few Republican senators that were like, that was just filler words. He was just trying to say something, you know, some just filling stuff. He didn't mean it. And I saw that even Lindsey Graham had like a mild, like, I don't think Trump meant to say that. So they didn't endorse it exactly. But this is the problem with everything Trump says. His own words are so meaningless that it's hard for him to be taken to account for them because no one can agree on what he meant in the first place. And he probably never even meant anything in the first place at all. Like, he's not using words to convey information. He's using words to convey positions and power. Like, that's all. So to some extent, there really isn't even an underlying content in his words to examine or draw meaning from.
See, I think you're letting him off the hook. I think he was very
clear. I'm not letting him off the hook. I'm just saying that there's a lot of nonsense in there that makes
I'm not going to chalk this up to his usual verbal diarrhea and nonsense. I think, like, you know, when pressed, he actually, if you...
Oh, no, it's intentional. He absolutely is signaling what he's going to do.
Because even when, like, Stephanopoulos pushed back and said, you know, well, what happens if the FBI director said it? Well, he said the FBI director is wrong. For those of you who are paying attention, FBI Director Christopher Wray has publicly advocated for notifying the FBI if a foreign country approaches, say, a presidential candidate and his campaign with opposition research, right? This is actually literally collusion. It's illegal. And so Trump said, nope, FBI Director is wrong. And so basically what the reason why I'm taking this so seriously, and I think it's not just word salad, and he's very deliberate, is he's just signaling to the American people that, A, not just to the American people, literally to the world. If you are a foreign country and you come to me with opposition research that will help me win, and it's all about winning, against my Democratic challenger, I will take it. So we've gone from there was no collusion to maybe if there was collusion, it's not that bad, to now, hey, collusion's fine. No problem. I don't think it's wrong or illegal. I get information from people all the time. Of course I'll use it. And then he also says, I've never called the FBI. Like in his life, right? And so he has really put himself, and I think the Republican Party, if we were in normal times, in a kind of intractable position. But you're trying to see today, I mean, it's still like, what, 5:30 p.m. right now on a Thursday. A lot of Republicans have done no comments. They've skirted around the issue. They realize this is very embarrassing. They realize it's made it very difficult for them. It's essentially, if you look at the consequences, if you're a foreign country, let's say you're China and Russia, this is green light. 2020, it's game time.
At the same time, they already knew that. It's not like it was a secret for them. If they wanted to try and get him on board with some kind of arrangement, they knew he was on board for it. Like, that was not up for question. The point is, like, this whole statement he gave, it is signaling the openness and is like he's refusing to commit to anything here, as usual. And the reason nothing's going to happen to him is because he is so meaningless with his words that what are you going to hold him in trouble for? Like, he's going to point to the fact he said that if something wrong happened, I'd go to the FBI. And his supporters will say, oh, look, he said if it was wrong, he'd go to the FBI. Well, of course, Trump's never going to find it wrong in the first place. He'll never need to go to the FBI. It is word salad. It is meaningful. It is establishing openly his position. He has absolutely taken dirt already from some foreign country. That's for sure. But it's sure. not going to make a difference because his words are meaningless in a real sense.
But this also goes to show you why words matter, especially.
No, they do. They do. But he's very good at making sure they don't. And that's.
Yeah, but like, it's also about precedent. It's also about decorum. And it's also like you don't say the stuff you're thinking out loud. It's like it always reminds me of like the Bond villain. Like when Bond's trying to escape, like he gets the villain to monologue. Like you're not supposed to monologue and like lay out your entire plan.
But I don't think that's what happened here. Because remember when Kushner had his interview on whatever, on Axios, whatever it was, he said the same answer. What? Like this is a pre-planned internal answer they've given. I mean, Trump's rambling makes it sound more confusing and spontaneous, but this was already the position they'd taken out.
So now collusion is okay.
Well, we're not going to call it collusion because that's not a real thing and it's distracting from the actual issues. And that's part of what he's trying to do is make everyone call it collusion when that's not relevant. And this like it isn't even necessarily collusion because collusion requires two parties to agree on something. And they're going to always portray it as, oh, we didn't agree to anything. We just accepted it and moved on. But it's still illegal and still wrong, even without the collusion aspect. Like even if genuinely there was no collusion, there was only one-sided giving of information and there's nothing going back the other way. So there's no kind of conspiracy, nothing like that. That is still a campaign finance violation. That is still arguably about its other FEC regulations.
Well, also just how it threatens and harms our intelligence
and that
and our national security. The fact that you have literally have now potentially hostile foreign governments openly invited to interfere in the democratic process, in the United States democratic process. That just by itself should give pause to any American listener to this. Like, huh, the president of the United States of America was supposed to put the national security of America first and foremost, which is, you know, allegedly this is an America first presidency, is now openly inviting hostile foreign countries to interfere in our elections because, hey, guys, I'm your man.
It's going to give no pause to them because he didn't say that in actual words. They,
I know, but
everyone knows that the underlying context, but without those words, it's not going to mean anything to them.
And he tweeted today, quote, I meet and talk to foreign governments every day. I just met with the Queen of England, UK, the Prince of Wales, spelled W-H-A-L-E-S, the PM of the United Kingdom, the PM of Ireland, the President of France, and the President of Poland. We talked about everything. Should I immediately call the FBI about these calls and meetings? How ridiculous. I would never be trusted again.
Yeah, and that tweet's problematic for a whole new reason, and that he is saying openly that he gets information, secret information, from foreign governments that he would never consider sharing with U.S. law enforcement intelligence agencies. Now, again, it is actually possible still that Trump is just engaging in word salad. You can't rule that out entirely. It does seem more part of like a coherent narrative strategy. This is something he is promoting with some sort of plan could be too strong a word, but like it's a theme he's running with.
He's been running with it for a while. This is the same man who said, Russia, if you're listening, yeah. That was right before the elections.
Yeah, but he's not taking this open sort of like. He definitely has a narrative shift lately in how he's framing it. With starting with Kushner and some comments before then, they're going to play it off as like, as long as you just take information, it's not a big deal. Now, side note though, the tweet that you're talking about does like 1,000% confirm something that's kind of been clear for a little while now, but was sort of on the fence about. Trump has learned to thread tweets.
Finally.
He has finally learned. For ages, he never knew how to do it. So it made it really easy to tell when it was him, when it was not. Because if it was threaded, it was not him.
He has how to spell, so that'll be the next step.
Past couple months, it had some batshit tweets that were threaded, and I just assume they were batshit White House tweets, but the Prince of Wales one confirms it. Now, this is definitely Trump has learned to press the little plus button and do multiple tweets at once.
Okay, so question. What should the Democrats do?
Impeachment? Yeah, of course they should. They're not going to do it, but they should. There's not really...
What will it take?
They won't do it. They've lost. If they already have all the smoking guns they could possibly want, they're not going to do it. That's not going to change.
I hope I'm wrong,
but like, there's very little indication that that's going to change. Because the problem is the polling. He's getting crushed in polling right now, and Democrats are unfortunately, large number of the ones in power are convinced they can ride this out. They're convinced that they can win, so it's not going to be a problem, and they're better off letting his awful, god-awful poll numbers crush him for them. I mean,
the poll number that came out just this week showed literally, like, everyone against Trump. Trump gets 40-42% no matter what. Like, you could literally put inanimate carbon rod versus Trump. Trump will get 40-42%. But it was interesting that Biden, Warren, Harris, all of them in a poll came out this week kind of outperformed Trump. 41% Trump was trending on Wednesday, and it led to some very funny tweets. So they're riding on that hope, you're correct, that the poll numbers are going to favor them, that they won't start these divisive impeachment hearings. But not starting impeachment, doesn't that help Trump?
I mean, I don't even care at this point about that. Like, the bigger concern is long-term democratic processes.
Of course.
The assumption they're making that Trump will actually leave if he loses is, well, we'll see how that works out for them. But they're banking everything on that, which is not a sound strategy right now. So yes, they absolutely should peach for it. They're not going to. What they should do more short-term is pass the frickin' bill that Mark Warner is trying to pass and try to pass today with unanimous consent. And of course, what's her face from Texas or Tennessee? Blackburn? Yeah, Marsha Blackburn.
Yeah, Marsha Blackburn, senator from Tennessee.
So one thing you can do if you want to like fast-track a bill, because usually it takes, obviously, you know, you're a bill on Capitol Hill, gotta go through all those stages. If you're in the Senate and you want to like do something really fast, you can have a unanimous vote. So if he has something that everyone's going to agree to and everyone's like, well, this is a no-brainer, let's just freaking do it right now. That's what Mark Warren was trying to do. And of course, there was an objection from Tennessee, so it didn't happen.
And she just, 26 minutes ago, she had a statement. She goes, I objected to the unanimous consent proposal presented on the floor because it was a blatant political stunt. My colleagues on the left tried to rush this legislation through the Senate without giving a chance for the careful consideration and debate needed to address such an important issue.
I mean, I don't disagree with that, because this is going to be a very difficult bill to word correctly. And I think it's worth taking time for it. It was a stunt in that sense that they were never going to get it this way. And I don't think it's necessarily best for this bill in particular to have it pass through a rush vote, because there are lots of concerns with constitutional concerns, concerns about like First Amendment. You don't want to criminalize something that shouldn't be criminalized, or get something so vague you can't enforce it. So yeah, it's not an easy bill to write, and they do need to take time to do it. So I'm not disappointed necessarily that Blackburn stopped it. But they do need to get that through before 2020. Before the election season really gets going, we need that in place.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately, which is sad, and it just shows you that the Democrats are terrible at messaging, because if this was happening to a Democratic president right now, you better believe that the Republican Party would be on top of it. There'd be messaging. They would be consistent across the board. They would promote it. They would communicate it. They would rinse, repeat, and they would rile up the base. Meanwhile, we have Nadler and Pelosi, and basically just a lot of wonks who are incapable of creating any message to save their life. Now, that's why I keep hoping for a wartime conciliary for the Democrats, and I just don't think it'll ever come.
Because they can't agree on the overall strategy. I mean, I think that they do have a message, and they're doing an effective job of trying to get it out there.
What's the message?
The message is that we can defeat Trump through other ways, and that we're better off not defeating him through impeachment, and that we should show him at the polls how much we don't want him. It's not working. It's definitely blunting the calls for impeachment, but it's not stopping them. So that extent, no, they're not succeeding. But they do have a fairly unified message come from the top.
But yeah, but it's not, to me, it's not effective at all.
Well, if you don't agree with the strategy, then it's not effective. But I mean, that's right now what they're trying to do.
It's so painful. It's so painful.
Well, here's for me what's most painful about Democratic messaging over the past couple weeks, and to me, most damaging. So we've had, a few different people have, or two different Democratic candidates and leadership have made various statements. But the two big ones that to me is one from Pelosi that came out, I think sort of leaked out, really. It wasn't a public statement, where she said, talking about the whole impeachment question, I don't want to see Trump impeached. I want to see him in prison.
Right.
Which, okay, what? Like, if you think he should be in prison, you should impeach him. So that's the dumbest argument you've ever made. But the basic claim is itself problematic, because obviously it's not like Republicans are shying away from it, but it is a very bad idea to have your political leader saying, I want my opponent in prison. Full stop. Yes, should never happen. Doesn't matter if Republicans are doing it. There's no like they started it. It's like it cannot happen in a democracy. It should not happen. You should not encourage it. Full stop. Hard stop. And it's even more insane here when Pelosi is like not going to do the thing she should do, which is impeach him, as opposed to just like hypothetically saying she'd be in prison. And then we have Kamala Harris, who took it a bit farther and recently said that when it comes to the whole obstruction question for Trump, if she was elected, she'd feel that she had no choice but to prosecute. Which, no, that is exactly where the Republicans have been for a while. And there's nothing good to be gained by Democrats following after. This is super dangerous because, I mean, how do you stop it now? If both sides are doing it, it's going to just keep on going like this. There's no one speaking out about it. And Trump, who obviously, again, has not been shy about calling for his critics to be locked up, has definitely escalated the rhetoric in recent months. He has really stepped it up. Like, there's been a ton of interviews I've caught, like, I've heard about them, like, heard some snippets. And then when I finally watched the whole thing, he'll have a few lines in there like, the Democrats committed crimes and will be locked up for them, investigated now. And no one's even talking about it. I mean, and you're like, what the frick? He is openly,
Yeah, that was today.
Another... Oh, that's a bunch of them. That's a bunch of them. This is like probably three or four different times past like a month or so. I've seen an interview where he said that and no one's commented on it. It's just now normal for him to do it.
So CIA agents, you know, CIA agents being interviewed by the Justice Department over the Russia investigation. That's already, that's another big piece of big news that came out last night. And so if you have your handpicked attorney general in place and you have Republicans who are acting as your henchmen, what do? You go after the watchmen. Right, especially if you're promoting a QAnon deep state conspiracy theory that everyone's corrupt and against you, you go after your enemies. That's what happens in dictatorships, and we're seeing that happening in slow motion right now in America.
And the single worst thing Democrats could do is to also embrace that rhetoric.
Of course. Oh, that's back. Exactly. It goes back to our original point, where this the corruption from the top rots all the way down, and you set such a negative precedent. And especially if you kind of have these broad powers where you just attack all your enemies. What will keep anyone, whether a Republican who comes in or a Democrat from coming, from aping and copying these behaviors to protect themselves? It's just human nature, right? It's like, hey, Trump got away with it. No one cared. Ooh, standards are looser now. Let me go after my enemies.
But even if they wouldn't do it, even if they wouldn't actually carry it out, it's actually just the messaging itself that is so problematic. I don't think they would actually get in. Like, obviously, Pelosi is not trying to get Trump prosecuted right now. That was rhetoric. But the existence of that on both sides means there is no break on this car right now.
Which is why you should actually engage in the impeachment process. Yeah. It's a process. And look, you know, and the sad part is Democrats have not, this is not Robert Mueller's job. Democrats have not done a good job of
Mueller's training. On a beach somewhere and like,
Hawaii. Yeah, chilling like a martini.
He has no job right now.
Yeah, like what I'm saying is it's the Democrats' job to communicate to the people what exactly happened in an impeachment process, because like the polls show that a majority of Americans think that Trump committed a crime, but they don't want him removed from office. Well, that's not exactly what impeachment is, right? It's like a process. So the fact that American people still don't know that impeachment does not equal, like, you know, immediate removal is a problem that the Democrats have to fix in their messaging and communication, which I think they can if there was some unified, smart strategy in place and they had a wartime conciliary, but they don't, because as usual, they're going the timid route of saying, listen, check out the polls. We'll just eventually get them out that way. And we don't want to be divisive. And, you know,
I don't think it's timid or about not being divisive. I don't think that's necessarily what's going on. I think they're just, they have faith in their current strategy. And I don't think it's
a timid strategy, though?
No.
With everything that.
No, not only that. I mean, I don't think timidness is necessarily a motivating factor there. I just think that they believe they're better off in the polls doing it this way. So it's not a question of like timidness, it's just a question of what they, how much faith they have in institutions to up.
They were also better off in the polls 2004 when Kerry was running up against George W. Bush.
Oh yeah, it's a poor call. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think it has to do with them being afraid of it. I just think that they believe they have it in the bag. So in other news, we mentioned past few episodes that we're not going to talk about Iran yet because hopefully that's going to happen. Something may finally be happening there. We have had probably past week, again, another escalation from an already existing escalation, but now it's really getting up there in terms of rhetoric, in terms of what people are talking about in administration. Last night, there was an attack on a couple of tankers in the Gulf of Oman, and so far today, all I've seen is that Pompeo has officially declared that Iran was responsible for it. Yeah. Like, is this the prelude to war? Hopefully not. But it's definitely not that either.
Yeah. First of all, it's a fantastic distraction because Pompeo made the statement in front of cameras and blamed Iran, but he did not present any evidence to back up that assessment, which is a very important fact that should be in all headlines right now, that Pompeo says or alleges that Iran is responsible for attack without providing any evidence. And as we know, as we've talked about, there has been an escalation over the past month, last 2 months specifically.
Yeah. It's been a slow, steady increase. And it's just like ramping up. I mean, it's not a good trend here.
No. Late last month, both Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton said that Iran was responsible for earlier attacks. Again, neither have presented evidence. And as of this conversation right now, Gulf of Tonkin is now trending. So many Americans are probably furiously Googling Gulf of Tonkin, trying to figure out what that was.
This
is in relation to the Iran story.
Bolton, there's no way that he's getting a second shot here. There's no way Bolton is not going to take his chance and go to war with at least one of his enemies. I think North Korea, he may have like decided he's not going to be able to get that present because Trump is opposed to it. But he wants something for his service, and he is not going to just walk away from this administration without having started a war.
I mean, this is the same man who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times advocating for the war in Iran. This is the same man who cheerled the war in Iraq, the disastrous war in Iraq. This is the same man who's openly wanted a regime change, actively wanted a regime change in Iran. And the reason why the Gulf of Tonkin is now trending is people are saying exactly what you just said, that the Gulf of Oman situation will be that excuse by this type of I shouldn't say Trump, I should say the war hawks in the Trump administration, namely John Bolton, to achieve that regime change in Iran. And also a fantastic distraction, and also a great gift to Trump's allies, specifically Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Iran, who want to nullify this threat right at their borders. So it's a win-win-win situation for a lot of friends, John Bolton, Pompeo, and Trump. But I don't know if Trump himself has the appetite for it. However, it will not be the first time where a war is a fantastic distraction from, say, impeachment or, say, hearings or investigations or damaging reckless comments.
Well, we also learned last night that apparently there was a presentation by Pompeo himself, it sounds like, to Congress, where either he or Department of State made the case that the 2001 AUMF covers war in Iran. What the fuck? I mean, it's not like I'm surprised to hear that, but like it's terrifying. And also, why the fuck? Of course they're going to say that, because the 2001 AUMF is like going to authorize war against space aliens 100 years from now. That's just how it's going to be. But there's no legitimate case to be made that the AUMF, which is what Congress had to pass in order to authorize the president to go to war, can extend past the 9/11 origins to Iran today.
But it doesn't matter, because both Democrats and Republicans signed off to the authorization to use military force in 2011 after the 9/11 terror attacks. And it has been used broadly by both administrations, right, Republican and Democrat, to essentially give the president.
Maybe Rand Paul will find his spine. It's like the one thing he comes out for.
Like this is literally the one thing Rand Paul is good for.
Yeah.
The one.
He might actually be like the one time where he might actually be more than just talk. Like he'll come to bat for this and this alone.
But I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is frightening, because that AUMF, it's still there. It's been there since for the last 18 years.
Just fucking burn it. Burn it with fire. Kill it with fire. Treat it like a giant nest of spiders and just get fucking rid of it, because we're going to have this problem forever until it's gone.
But you need a spine. You need both Republicans and Democrats with a spine, and whoever goes against it, I mean, you can immediately imagine, why are you not protecting America? Why are you making us weak? Why don't you worry about our national security? We have Iran, which is a radical actor. I mean, who's going to be the brave soul to like literally cheerlead this? Like,
Rand Paul, buddy, counting on you. Now's your time to do something good for America.
To give credit, you got Congressman Liu, who came out and tweeted about it. And then Barbara Lee, she tweeted about it. There might be a few others. But that is terrifying, because that's the precedent put in place. Again, it's kind of a theme throughout our conversation here, right? Once it's put in place, why do you expect actors, I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat, to do the right thing and rein in power that has been given to them? And that power sometimes, oftentimes, is used and abused to engage in disastrous acts such as the Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan, and God forbid we go to war with Iran. Of course, maybe we will, because nobody ever learns from history. And John Bolton's lifelong dream will be fulfilled, and he can like literally die happy as he presses the red button. Like,
here's the other problem, though. In the current situation, do I believe Pompeo and his claims that they have attributed this attack to the Iranians? No, flat out, do not. Just don't. And that's scary, because I'm not alone in that. And people all over the world, in the country, in the administration, in the Senate, and Congress, are also just not Gwendolyn Pompeo. Now, this could have been from Iran. Like, it's not impossible. And they can also bank on the fact that they know that if they do something like that, there's going to be only a fraction of people who actually believe Pompeo. They could do it openly almost. And unless Pompeo gives them, like, flat-out proof, people are going to be skeptical. So this is a danger in that we can no longer trust our administration to tell us if we are or are not being attacked by someone. Because, yeah, you can't take their word for it. They're not going to show underlying data. And it's not impossible that there was an attack like they're saying. But how do we know? We can't anymore.
No, we don't. And it just, it like, you know, if you, for those of you who are paying attention, just watch the escalation the last few months. The escalation. And so let's hope some sober minds prevail. And let's hope America has lost its appetite for war in the Middle East. But I feel like that appetite is never really satiated. So, yeah.
Well, knock on wood. Hopefully next week we'll have no Iran updates for you. That's my goal.
Yeah, no Iran updates, except maybe some Cuba Day recipes. That would be lovely.
That's fine. Just no other big Iran updates. God forbid. At least Venezuela has like gone off the radar. I guess I gave up on war there. So we got that going for us.
No, don't worry. That's going to come back.
Probably next week. I probably jinxed it. If I did, sorry, guys.
Literally just jinxed it. You know, we were doing okay. And then the right there was like the fates were like, oh, thank you, Susan.
Well, we had forgotten. We'll be back next week to talk about war in Venezuela, probably. Or maybe something happier. So,
really not.
Until then, thanks for listening. And we'll be back next week on the 45th. Thanks, Waj.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.